Thank you for joining us on Chicago Tonight, Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. On the show tonight, what to expect as the state's Reparations Commission kicks off public hearings. A deep dive into how to reduce mass incarceration in America.
Part of my dreams as well, but didn't know it was going to happen so soon.
And how a local organization is helping people purchase their first home. And now to some of today's top stories. In releasing its nearly $10 billion budget, Chicago Public Schools says the budget shortfall this year is bigger than expected. Officials say additional costs in health care and special education added more than $100 million to the deficit, bringing the total up to $505 million. CPS says to fill that gap, it's made some departmental cuts and debt restructuring, among other cost-saving efforts. Meanwhile, under the new funding model, the district says 95% of its operating budget funds will go directly to schools. And while some schools will see reduced funding levels next year, the total amount CPS allocates for school budgets will not be cut. And neighbors in Beverly, Morgan Park, and Auburn Gresham are still under a boil order at least until tomorrow morning. A high-pressure water main leak inside the Roseland pumping station Tuesday night led the Chicago Department of Water Management to issue the order. Though the water main is back online and fully pressurized, the department is still testing if it's safe to drink. Residents in the area should bring water to a full rolling boil for at least 5 minutes to ensure that it's safe for consumption. And for more on storing boiled water and where to pick up free bottled water, please visit our website. Governor J.B. Pritzker is signing into law measures designed to make health care coverage easier for consumers and patients. Pritzker's office says the main target of the Health Care Protection Act is banning step therapy. That's the practice of insurance companies requiring patients to try and fail on several medications and treatment options before covering the care preferred by their doctors. The legislation also eliminates prior authorization requirements for patients seeking inpatient mental health care and bans the sale of so-called junk insurance plans that don't meet Affordable Care Act standards.
I'm thinking about how this will change and save the lives of those experiencing a mental health crisis. Let me be clear. Insurance-invented roadblocks like prior authorization requirements have put people directly into harm's way.
And up next, an update on Illinois' reparations efforts right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Illinois residents looking to weigh in on reparations, here's your chance. The state's Reparations Commission is kicking off public hearings across Illinois, with the first in Chicago on Saturday. Commission is tasked with researching and reporting on possible reparatory actions for Black residents who are descendants of slavery. Leaders say the public's input will be used in developing proposals for policymakers. Joining us now with more are Daniel Davis, an associate professor of Africana Studies and African American History at Kennedy King College, and one of the hearing's featured speakers. And joining us through Zoom is Marvin Slaughter, the board chair of the African Descent Citizens Reparations Commission. Thanks to you both for joining us. So, Marvin, let's start with you, please. Tell us about the commission and why we need it.
Yes. Well, you know, the commission originally was started in 2021. It was an ambitious plan by the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus to dismantle systemic racism in the state of Illinois. So the caucus introduced legislation to reform four key pillars of Illinois government. And this work falls under the reformation of the economic access, equity, and opportunity pillar. It is definitely something that is extremely important in understanding that the Black community's barriers to economic access, equity, and opportunity are so large. So this is part of the reason why this work and these efforts are so important.
As you mentioned, this law, the law created the commission back in 2021, when, of course, at the time, the Black Caucus managed to usher through a number of other very specific laws for the Black community. Why are we just now getting to hearings? Bring us up to speed on what the commission has been doing for the last 2 years.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So the commission has been doing various public engagement events in the community. We've been attempting to get the word out and start doing some of the educational work. We have hosted events in Springfield, in East St. Louis, and Chicago. Last fall, we brought Nicole Hannah-Jones for a conversation with one of our commissioners, Commissioner Dr. Ted Williams III. And we've been, you know, putting our heads down and beginning to get to work. In addition to that, we have onboarded our research team and have begun the work that is going to be necessary in producing our harm report.
And Marvin, before I bring Daniel in as well, what can we expect for the discussion at the hearing, and what do you want to hear from the public?
Indeed, indeed. So, you know, the form of the hearing will take, we'll have three expert speakers who will kind of ground us. We'll have Dr. Daniel Davis, Dr. Peter Cole, and Fred Hampton Jr. And they will be speaking to three issues, enslavement, racial terror, and political disenfranchisement. Then we'll have a section of registered public comment where we will have three members who have already registered to speak from the community that will talk to each of those three issues. And then we'll go into the in-person public comment where individuals who show up and sign up will have an opportunity to give a two-minute one-way comment to explain either their family narrative or recommendations that they might have for the commission. And ultimately, you know, we understand that the public input is extremely important to us, and it serves as one of the core pillars of input to both our harm report and what recommendations we will consider and tender to the Illinois State Legislature. Expertise comes in many forms, and the commission, although it's comprised of many subject matter experts, we recognize the limitations of our own knowledge, and we value the lived experiences of citizens of Illinois, particularly the lived experiences of citizens from the harm community.
Well, sorry, I just wanted to get Daniel Davis in here as well, because as he mentioned, you're going to be speaking specifically about the role of slavery in Illinois. I think a lot of folks would be surprised to learn that that was something that actually happened here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, usually when people think of slavery, first off, most people don't know enough about slavery, right? People may feel they know, but they don't really understand. Even with that said, people usually think it was in the South only, right? Now, yes, it was heavily concentrated in the South, but Northern slavery was a real thing. Illinois was also guilty of this sin. Beginning in 1720, all the way until emancipation, there was a lot of slavery in Illinois. So to piggyback off of what he was stating about contemporary issues, right, that African-Americans are facing in the state, we have to understand the connection between slavery and all the things that we were kept from as a people, as African Americans, and how that prevented us from building generational wealth, created a social atmosphere where African Americans were looked at as second class, even third class citizens, or less than human, and how that still impacts us today. So it's important that people understand that history.
And what did that look like in Illinois in, like you said, 1720? Because a lot of folks hear slavery and we imagine, obviously, plantation slavery, but yes, it can exist, like you said, in a place that did not have the same sort of plantations that maybe Mississippi or Alabama.
Absolutely. So there were also plantations here, but there were salt mines and other places where they were enslaving African Americans, much like the South, working backbreaking labor, being sold, having your children sold away from you, being whipped, being sexually assaulted, etc., and working for free, right? Being banned from, you know, normal avenues of success that other Americans got to enjoy. So all of those things happened in Illinois, just like Mississippi, Alabama, and other southern places.
Many people argue that slavery happened generations ago, hundreds of years ago. Why should there be reparations for it today? Why should the humans, the people of today, have to pay for something that happened so long ago? What is your argument?
Yes, and that is the core question, right? So again, being blocked from building generational wealth to pass down to your family, what people have to realize is that while African Americans were working for free, being cut off from building wealth, white Americans that owned slaves were building their wealth, and their children get to benefit from that, right? We even, I'll be speaking about this at the event, but there's even things like military vouchers that weren't discussed or that aren't discussed enough. In Illinois, if you're an enslaved person, nobody's born a slave, so we don't like to use slave, right? So if your enslaved person was sent off to fight in war, you would be compensated for that. You would get a voucher from the government to pay for that lost person or that lost property. I mean, that's a form of reparations, if you will, and payment, and among a long list of others, right? So we've seen reparations for white people and others for generations. Why are African Americans excluded?
And Daniel first and then Marvin, because we've got a limited amount of time. Sorry, just about a minute and a half left. Daniel, why do you think the discussion on reparations has shifted so much in the last 2 years?
That's a good question. I mean, I would like to say that, you know, the work that myself and the commission and others are doing is spreading the word, right? I think that the word is getting out more and people are realizing that, you know, something's not right here. Through education, I'm biased, so I teach African-American history and Africana studies, but through pushing out that word that African-Americans aren't disproportionately in low-income environments. We aren't disproportionately failing in school, disproportionately having these problems because something's wrong with us as a people. There are causal factors, macro-level, micro-level, historical factors that put us in this position, and I think that word is starting to spread, and I'm happy to see it.
Marvin, a couple seconds left. You know, once upon a time, you know, talking about reparations was a non-starter. Why do you think that conversation has shifted?
You know, I think that it's shifted primarily because of the sharing of the lived experiences of those from the impacted community. And to that end, I can't stress stress the importance enough of showing up and sharing that lived experience. Recommendations for how reparations should be implemented in Illinois and why this issue is so vital to the impacted community.
All right. We look forward to hearing more about these hearings as they go on. And of course, when the commission does come up with its recommendations, Marvin Slaughter, Daniel Davis, thanks to you both for joining
us.
Thank you. And up next, how to reduce mass incarceration in the U.S.
Make WTTW your home for 2024 convention coverage. Find the latest news on our website at WTTW.com/news. And spend each convention night with us beginning at 5:30 p.m. with live Chicago Tonight reporting and analysis from the convention before and after PBS NewsHour's primetime coverage. WTTW, your source for trusted, independent news and information.
People are incarcerated at much higher rates than their white counterparts. Nationally, the incarceration rate for black people is 6 times higher. And in Illinois, the rate jumps to 7.5, according to the Prison Policy Initiative. Racial disparities are just one of the many topics discussed in the new book, Dismantling Mass Incarceration, a Handbook for Change. And joining us now with more is one of the co-authors, Maria Hobolo, and professor at Loyola University Chicago's Law School. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here tonight.
And of course, we should mention you co-edited this book and co-wrote it along with two other authors who are not with us right now, but we know them.
yes.
Tell
yes.
us, if you would, about the book. Why did you all want to bring together this collection of ideas?
Well, thank you for allowing me to be here. As you mentioned, I co-edited this with Premal Darya and James Foreman. The three of us are former public defenders in Washington, D.C. And when we first began working as public defenders, I started working about 2 decades ago as a public defender, the conversation around the prison system was very different than it is today. We were passing laws to lock up more and more people for longer and longer times. The rates of disproportionate impact, racist impact, were higher even then, and the policies were even more punitive. And as I sort of progressed through my career and I began teaching a course on mass incarceration, there had been a shift in the conversation and in the communities. We saw the largest protests worldwide in the summer of 2020, and the conversation around criminal justice as a racial justice and civil rights issue really began to take hold. The conversation was changing. And what we wanted to see, what students kept asking, was, okay, we understand the causes and we understand the destruction and the consequences caused by a system that locks up millions of people across the United States, that keeps them from their families, that essentially destroys communities and health and education and futures. How can we do something about it? What can we do? And each of us came to it from that perspective, whether we were giving talks or talking to students or thinking about it and reflecting on our careers. And so this book is an effort both to highlight those changes, the changes of people and ordinary people and system actors and jurisdictions around the country, and you know, to show what is possible.
And so it's a collection of essays, papers, writings from, you know, multiple other subject matter experts like yourselves, broken down into six sections: police, prosecutors, public defenders, judges, prisons, and, of course, aftermath. How did you arrive at those specific topics and divisions of the system?
Sure. You know, both because of our work as public defenders, because we've been working within the system, and our own sort of work, the system is not one system. There isn't a single actor or person or bureaucracy responsible for the creation and growth of this prison system and jail system. And so what we wanted to show was this system is really broken down all the way from when people first come into contact with the criminal system, that's usually police and arrests, all the way through and past prison, because most people continue to feel what Professor Michelle Alexander calls civil death, the consequences of this vast system, aftermath, the inability to get jobs, the inability to vote in this in important
states, in federal,
elections,
yes,
in some states and in federal, the inability to even apply to get training in certain fields or find housing. And so we wanted to show really that this is not a system that can be dismantled by any one particular actor, but that there are opportunities to intervene at all along these junctures.
So in the prosecutor section, you note a 2019 study from the Reflective Democracy Campaign revealing that 95% of our country's prosecutors are white and 76% male. What is the impact of that lack of diversity on the non-system and its defendants?
That's an excellent question. As you mentioned, there are the system itself disproportionately impacts black and brown people, young black men, brown people, and when the prosecutor, one of the most important actors in the system, the person tasked or the office tasked with charging people, isn't representative of the community. After all, the prosecutor speaks in our name, in a community's name. This is how accountability for harm has been conducted in the United States. Then we don't get the sort of diversity and the holistic understanding and accountability to address those harms that we might want to see if we had a more diverse prosecution team.
You talk about the shift to progressive prosecutors, which aren't possible, you know, everywhere in the country, obviously, for political reasons, including, of course, Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, who has been identified among sort of a crop of progressive prosecutors who popped up in the last 8-ish years. What does that mean to be a progressive prosecutor?
I think what the book tries to highlight is that there isn't any single metric, and there isn't one sort of clean litmus test that says this person or this office is progressive and this office is not progressive. The question is, look, the prosecutors play this incredibly important role in our system. They engage in plea deals. They provide discovery. They make the charging decision, which ultimately leads oftentimes to the sentencing decisions. And so can we do this in a more just way? Can we address harms and safety and do so in a more just way? And this is where ordinary people paying attention to their local elections and organizing around, you know, is this person going to really consider, like Larry Krasner did in Philly in a memo to his staff, mass incarceration as one of the harms that needs to be reduced? There are prosecutors who are doing so, and it's not a straight line. You see stops and starts and setbacks, and I think that's the other point.
Some of them take criticism and pushback.
Yes, and some of them take criticism and pushback, and I think that's the other point. The system wasn't built in a year or 2 years or 3 years. It's been decades and decades, going all the way back we're not going to dismantle it in a year or 2 years or 3 years. We need time.
And certainly not with one prosecutor.
Or with one public defender or with one judge. Exactly. That's sort of the point.
In Illinois, we also know that blacks are overrepresented in the state's prisons. Of course, they make up 14% of the state's population, but they make up more than half of both prison and jail populations across the state of Illinois. You also compare U.S. to other countries. What can we learn from other countries' prison systems?
I think quite a lot. We have a piece on Norway and the prison system in Norway. And there's a question about, you know, and this book grapples with tensions, and we welcome these tensions. We debated them ourselves, and we want other people to debate them as well. Is abolition the right response, perhaps, or should we reform some of the conditions? People in prison are living under inhumane conditions. And in Norway, for instance, there has been an effort to call people by their names, to let them wear their own clothing. These seem like small and incremental changes. But as people are going from here and studying those types of changes, we can maybe learn something from them. How can we apply them to our local community? How can we humanize what has become an inhumane and outrageous system?
Yeah, it's a nation that, in my coverage of prisons, I've heard a lot about the work that they do in their prison systems. About, you know, 10 seconds left. What do you want people to take away from this, or what can people do themselves if they want to get involved?
I think people can do. What I want people to take away is that there are places to get involved in every part, including holding book clubs, learning about it, talking and organizing around local elections. And also just stepping in and watching what's going on, paying attention to the news and learning about the system.
Attention to the news right here. Maria Havala, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you
we
for having me.
And again, the book is Dismantling Mass Incarceration, A Handbook for Change. Up next, how a local organization is helping people buy their first home.
Stories about Chicago home ownership are supported by funding from the Chicago Community Trust.
Purchasing a home, navigating the loan process, and finding the best mortgage rate can be stressful. But one local organization is working to bridge the gap and help people purchase their first home. We originally brought you this story earlier this year. Here's Joanna Hernandez with another look.
Got three.
It's an incredible moment of joy and excitement for newlyweds Stephen Wells and Thanais Valdez.
Come on into our new house.
As they're welcomed to their brand new home.
I feel like we're breaking like generational curses. Like my mom doesn't even own a home.
Oh wow, look, we got a brand new plan.
It's a phone call from the organization Renew that they say changed their lives.
I was in California visiting family, and they were like, yeah, congratulations, you guys got approved for the program, and even better news, we have a home ready for you right in time for your wedding. And I'm like, wow.
Renew Communities is a nonprofit organization that is rehabbing and building new homes in the suburb of North Chicago. Tom Corning oversees the design and construction of what they call Matthew Homes.
So you can see that everything's open plan so that the family interacts with each other. Open to the basement, open in the living room, dining room. Children can sit here at the bar and do their homework while mom's cooking,
so
dad's cooking dinner in the kitchen. Very purposeful. You can see that the windows facing outside are large, looking out onto the street. And then the front porch, of course, is the welcoming aspect of this home to draw community to this family.
Welcome to your new house. This is for you. Lots of goodies.
The community has long struggled with low homeownership rates. Only 33% of residents in North Chicago own a home, according to Renew. The young couple says purchasing their first piece of property is an opportunity.
A lot of us were not prepared for all the money that it takes to save up for a down payment, save up for paying all these different fees that you have to pay. We're planning a wedding, so that takes money too. So I'm like, how are we gonna pay for a wedding and pay to have a down payment for a house? So it was definitely a blessing to be able to have a home.
The program partners with subcontractors and volunteers to build these homes. A Matthew home is sold for anywhere between $175,000 and $250,000. Renew selects a family to help them through the buying process and closing fees. Then Transform Capital assists with the mortgage rate.
Transform Capital saw that it's very difficult for some of their clients to access financing at attractive rates for a whole host of reasons that continue to this day. And so we created Transform Capital that steps in alongside Renew, and we take donated capital, we turn it into below market mortgages, and then lending is just a reason to be in relationship with families. And so we walk alongside them, and as they pay the loan, it creates recyclable capital that serves another neighbor.
The organization is on a mission to build 300 homes in the community. Longtime resident Cheryl Dunlap says it's a chance for families to build generational wealth while contributing to the area's development.
Any family that is within this program, they have resources. Renew is a resource. The other Matthew Home family owners are resources, as well as the volunteers. So it's really creating what I feel a diverse family.
The young couple is now living in the group's 17th home, and they say they're excited to continue to build their roots in the neighborhood.
Are you guys hoping to have, in the future, have some babies?
Oh, absolutely.
For Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, I'm Joanna Hernandez.
The organization calls them Matthew Homes, referencing a passage in the Bible. Since we first brought you this story, the organization says it is about to deliver its sixth home. For information on how to apply for a home or to be a volunteer, please visit our website. And that's our show for tonight. Be sure to check out our website, WTTW.com/news, for the very latest from WTTW News. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to recognize its founder and senior partner, Robert Clifford, who ranked number one in the state of Illinois by Super Lawyers Top 10 2024 Illinois Super Lawyers List.